Welcome to another round of going more and more deeply into Dogen's Buddha nature teaching. In some ways I feel like, you know, as we week by week study this and go into it more, I feel like he's just getting more and more difficult. He's just going wild with playing with Buddha nature through words that that point us in different directions, that pull out the rug from underneath us again and again. So what can we say about, you know, listening in this kind of a class if you feel like you're just getting totally lost and you don't know what's going on here with Dogen and Buddha nature? That may be a good thing. And maybe what he's trying to do is, if we have some comfortable understanding of Buddha nature, like, we got it, I get what that is, he's constantly turning that. So it's okay, you can let that happen. And if you feel like, I really think I get it, Dogen's pointing at it from all these different ways, I think I really got what it is, and it's pretty simple, and so I don't need to listen anymore. We might feel that too. And I feel like it has such an effect on me to study this. I feel like I can get into that. Like, yeah, I got what he's saying. He's just going to say it over and over again. But I feel like he's not just saying it over and over again. He's pointing at all different facets of this jewel of Buddha nature. I can feel my kind of understanding shift. Both conceptual, but sometimes the words are like, they have a kind of conceptual layer, or our experience of the words have a kind of conceptual layer, and then there's something deeper too that can't quite say what it is, but it's coming through the words. This class is about words. That's how we're relating to Buddha nature in a so-called class. And yet these words can touch something deeper. Sometimes, quite literally, I feel it in the body, hearing these, hearing a certain sentences, and, you know, I'm in this sort of engrossed mode with various translations out and the Chinese dictionaries and all the footnotes, and a certain sentence will come and I just start laughing. A laugh just like comes out from underneath. I'm like, wow, that just like, that laugh came from some, like, beyond, not in the words, you know, but it was triggered by the words. Sometimes, you know, just great respect for Dogen's diligence and very careful articulation of Buddha nature, and sometimes just joy at his playfulness. So I hope you can enjoy this as it gets difficult. It's already been difficult. But and another joy I think of this is just you know, unpacking the just infinitely rich tradition of Zen. All these Zen stories Dogen's constantly bringing up and referring to, either the whole story or just a little snippet of a story. And again, just for me, increases my awe and amazement at this, the depth of the Zen school and its teachings. So that's a little pep talk at the beginning. Are you ready? So we left off in this version somewhere in middle of page 2, or The paragraph, the utterance, if the time arrives, means the time is already here. I think that's where we left off.
Oh, 66.
I'm just going to back up one sentence to just bring up one point before we move on. The last sentence we ended on. If you wish to know the Buddha nature, you must realize that it's nothing other than temporal conditions themselves. So this is the end of Dogen's commentary on this saying of the Buddha about contemplating temporal conditions. Which, as you may recall, is already a surprising idea if you've been hearing about the classic teachings of Buddha nature, that it's beyond all time and space, that it's it doesn't come and go. And here the Buddha saying, contemplate temporal conditions or the time of cause and effect, of causes and conditions. Literally, it's like time causes conditions. Contemplate that to realize Buddha nature. And though it sounds unusual, I just want to refer back to the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. That, remember, the beginning of Dogen's essay begins with this statement from chapter 33 in the sutra. The sutras of the Buddha says, to utter the lion's roar means to make it known that all sentient beings have Buddha nature and the Tathagata always abides without change. That beginning sentence is from this chapter. So, Tathagata abides without change, always abiding without change. And then later in this chapter, 33, the Buddha is saying to one of the bodhisattvas, the wisdom that can meditate on the 12 links of conditionality or interdependence, you maybe know of the 12 links of dependent co-arising, the wisdom that can meditate on that is the seed that gains one unsurpassed enlightenment. And we may hear that kind of statement in the early teachings. The Buddha taught this 12-fold chain of conditionality. The 12 links are basically the conditions of how discontent arises in the world, beginning with ignorance leading to like the mass of suffering, how the mind works to create suffering. It's a wonderful psychological kind of model of causality. The causality of suffering. It's also called dependent co-arising of suffering. So without going into the whole 12 links, because it's a big teaching, the Buddha says here, the wisdom that meditates on these 12 links of interdependence or conditionality, causes and conditions, is the seed that gains unsurpassed enlightenment. So we hear that a lot in the early teachings. And then he says, for this reason, we call the 12 links of conditionality Buddha nature. So that's a big leap, connecting the early teachings of Buddha with these new Mahayana Buddha nature teachings, which is, you know, that was a really surprising thing to hear. We call the 12 links of dependent co-arising Buddha nature. Because usually we say Buddha nature isn't really the realm of dependent co-arising. It's the realm of nothing's arising and ceasing. It's this unchanging nature of mind, emptiness, empty, aware nature of mind. But here is just talking about this classic Buddhist teaching of causes and conditions is Buddha nature. Then a little bit down in this chapter, the Buddha says, causeless and resultless is the Buddha nature. So we're back to Buddha nature is causes and conditions, but Buddha nature is not caused. You can see that difference. It's dependent co-arising. It's the whole being of interdependent arising and ceasing. We call that Buddha nature. But that Buddha nature that is this whole being of causes and conditions, that whole being is not caused. This little distinction, but very important one. And I think that that understanding is something that Dogen's playing with throughout his writing too. Causeless and resultless is Buddha nature, as it does not arise out of causality. It is eternal and knows no change. So now he's back to that one, that version. Buddha nature is eternal and knows no change. That's why I say in the sutra, the meaning of the 12 links of conditionality is deep-rooted and none can grasp it, see it, or conceive it. All these are things of the world of all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's not within the reach of Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. Just got to bring that one in there, right? And the Buddha does say, even in those early teachings, dependent co-arising is very profound. Don't think that you can easily grasp it. It's inconceivable, actually. So he's reiterating that here. Dependent co-arising is inconceivable. Dependent co-arising is Buddha nature. The 12 links of dependent co-arising is Buddha nature. I don't have the Chinese for this. It'd be interesting to see exactly what it says. And yet Buddha nature itself is not caused or conditioned. It is causes and conditions. So that's a little reference. I think this Dogen's in accord with this Parinirvana Sutra when he says back to Dogen, if you wish to know the Buddha nature, you must realize that it is nothing other than temporal conditions themselves. Yeah. Now, this is where we begin. The utterance, if the time arrives, means the time is already here, and there can be no room to doubt it. So this is, I'll just mention some of these things that he's playing with in the Chinese, that he's playing with words. So just like we remember the beginning when the sutra says all beings have Buddha nature, that character in Chinese that translated as have can also mean are, and Dogen turns it to, he's constantly turning language that implies duality or implies like something's going to happen in the future. He's trying to find creative ways to turn that. So he turns all beings have Buddha nature to all beings are Buddha nature. And in this case, it's this character called, in Japanese pronounced nya, which is usually read as if, translated as if, but there's a kind of a rare translation, apparently. Not a common use of this word, nya, but it can also be translated as already. It's another meaning of that word, nya. So, the utterance, if the time arrives, means the time is already arrived. So, you know, he's reinterpreting, if the time arrives means already the time arrives. You understand? He's turning that character to a more uncommon meaning, but to make it, the time has arrived right now. Buddha nature is here. Hallelujah. And there can be no room to doubt it. Even if you do doubt it, that the time has arrived, and thereby the Buddha nature has arrived, you may do so. But then return the Buddha nature to me. Which you could take as, in different ways, and I think this is comes up in some Zen sayings, which I can't recall right now, but you could hear it as, you know, you're doubting, you can doubt that the time has arrived and Buddha nature is here right now, and that doubt doesn't hinder the Buddha nature arising, and Buddha nature can include our doubt, and yet because you're, you know, not so sure about it, you know, give me your Buddha nature temporarily for safekeeping. Let me take care of it until you have no doubt, and then I'll give it back. That'd be one way to hear it. Or you could hear it as, you know, return it to me, meaning like each one of us is the complete whole of Buddha nature. It's like, you know, your doubt out there is really me. You and your doubt, please just return that to me. Which you could hear in it, maybe a practical way of like, I understand what's going on here. Why is that person over there doubt what's going on? We could say a good practice for us at that time, if we start to feel like separate, is actually that doubting person is me. And their Buddha, their doubting Buddha nature is my Buddha nature. Maybe like a sort of like Dogen-esque Tonglen practice. you know, you're doubting, but return your doubting Buddha nature to me. I don't know. It just occurs to me right now. As for if the time arrives, you should know that throughout the 24 hours of the day, no time passes without its already being come. And this is just a kind of meditation on time here. Time is not something that happens in the future. Time, as we know from Dogen's Uji fascicle, time and being cannot be separated. Whatever is arising at any moment is time. There's no actual future or past, really. It's always now. If the time is already here, the Buddha nature does not have to come. Hence, the time being already arrived is in itself the immediate manifestation of the Buddha nature. Or, this truth is clear and self-evident. There has never yet been a time not arrived. There can be no Buddha nature that is not Buddha nature manifested right here and now. So, one line from Uji, Shobogenzo Uji, Dogen's essay called The Time Being. Dogen says, mountains are time and oceans are time. If time is destroyed, mountains and oceans are destroyed. So everything that comes forth, like mountains and the great sea, is actually time. And so if time disappeared, so do the mountains and waters. It's not like the mountains and waters are things happening in time, or it's not like mountains and rivers have time inside them. There's no separation between the appearing world and time, or time and being.
Mm-hmm. It could also mean that if mountains and rivers disappeared, time would disappear.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they go together. Time and being are not two. So now we have the next story. Dogen's going to bring up the next story. The 12th ancestor, Ashvaghosha, in expounding the Buddha nature sea, Buddha nature ocean, for the sake of the 13th ancestor, Kapimala, said, the forming or constructing of mountains, rivers, and the great earth itself is totally dependent on Buddha nature. Samadhi, concentration practice, and the six supernatural powers are being revealed or manifest through Buddha nature. That's the story. And to hear the kind of extended version in the transmission of light, where these stories come from. Kapimala. So this is the our ancestors in our lineage. Anabote Daiyosho, Kapimala Daiyosho. In these, the Indian stories in the transmission of light are very kind of magical and fanciful, kind of like Lord of the Rings type stuff. So I just, you know, enjoy these stories and like, where did these come from? It, you know, once it gets into the Chinese ancestors, there's a less magic going on. I think that maybe the Chinese and Japanese think of India as like this place where things like the six supernatural powers are happening and all kinds of, it's a mystical land in the West, right? So so this is about Kapimala, and before he met Ashvaghosha. He was a non-Buddhist yogi and had 3,000 followers, studied different theories, and well, I'll skip some of the story because you can read it yourself if you like, but to get through Dogen, I'll just go down to this ending part. Basically, he appears in these various different transformations. He turns into to a woman and talks to Ashvaghosa. Then he turns into like a dragon in the sky. And then after these various encounters, he turns into a small insect appeared, no larger than a speck, and concealed itself beneath Ashvaghosa's seat. Ashvaghosa picked it up in his hand and said to the assembly, "This is the transformation of this demon, Kapimala. He's now transformed himself into a tiny insect. He just wants to eavesdrop on my teaching." Because he's sitting on the teaching seat here. "He released the insect, but it was unable to move. Ashvaghosa spoke to it, saying, 'If you will just take refuge in the three treasures, you will regain your powers.' The demon at once resumed his former shape as a person, bowed and repented. Ashvaghosa asked him, 'What's your name? And how many followers do you have?' And this demon replied, 'I'm Kapimala, and I have 3,000 followers.' Ashvaghosa asked, 'What can you do? What can you do when you use all your magical powers?' The demon replied, 'I consider changing the great ocean to be very easy.' And Ashvaghosa asked him, 'Can you transform the ocean of Buddha nature?'" So this is where the ocean gets brought in, or the sea, Buddha nature sea. The demon asked, "What do you mean by the ocean of Buddha nature?" "It's a setup." "I still don't completely understand." Then the story happens of Ashvaghosa said, as it goes here, the forming of mountains, rivers, and the great earth is totally dependent on the Buddha nature ocean. Samadhi and the six supernatural powers are being revealed or manifested through this Buddha nature ocean. So now you can see why, what the connection is to these six supernatural powers here. Why that, how that fits in, because he's talking to this kind of yogic magician, basically, that has these kind of powers. And He's saying all these things that you think you're so powerful and can do with that, all of that is really all coming from Buddha nature. So why don't you just take refuge in Buddha? Because that's the source of all everything that you can do, no matter how great it is. In this way, mountains, rivers, and the great earth are all the Buddha nature, sea or ocean. The forming or constructing of mountains, rivers, the great earth itself is totally dependent, means that the very time they are being formed is mountains, rivers, and the great earth. So we could hear this to be, it's not like there's this thing called Buddha nature that's the cause of, like, over here, the result of mountains, rivers, and earth. Remember that the sutra that we just heard, the Parinirvana Sutra, says Buddha nature is not a cause or a result of anything. It's more like the totality, right, of all causes and conditions. So Dogen's way of saying this is totally dependent means that the very time these mountains, rivers are formed is the mountains, rivers, and earth. So we could hear like the kind of dependence of like waves being dependent on the ocean. It's not like there's an ocean over here that then causes the waves over here. The waves are like part of the ocean, but we can say that the waves are dependent on the ocean. They're neither the same nor different, right? Waves in the ocean are neither the same nor different, but they have an interdependent relationship. Or if we were to ask, what is the relationship between waves and ocean? You might say, well, waves are part of an ocean, but are they really, if you separate the parts out, then what happens to the ocean? So this kind of like the parts and a whole, you could say the relationship of parts and a whole is a relationship of interdependence. And Nagarjuna, with his logic, often brings up this point of everything is dependently arisen. So if you start looking for a whole and its parts, you just find a relationship of interdependence, the middle way. So it's a little bit hard, a strange way of saying this here, talking about this kind of dependence, but I think Dogen's trying to make it clear that this total mountains, rivers, and earth totally dependent on Buddha nature means that the very time they're being formed is the mountains, rivers, and earth. There's no separation between Buddha nature and mountains, rivers, and earth, and that non-separation is a kind of dependence here. As for the forming is totally dependent on the Buddha nature, you should know that the mode of the Buddha nature see is like this. It's not concerned with inner or outer or in between. As the Buddha nature see is like this, seeing mountains and rivers is seeing Buddha nature. Seeing Buddha nature is seeing a donkey's jowls or a horse's mouth. And one footnote said that this is just a Chinese colloquial expression of just ordinary things. Isn't that, in English we have that phrase, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, right? Which I, you know that phrase? We don't use it so much anymore, right? But I think the phrase is because if you're buying a horse, you look at its teeth to assess its health. Pretty sure. What's that?
Tells you the age.
Maybe age and health. So I think that the English expression is kind of like, you know, if somebody's giving you a horse, you don't, you know, if somebody's giving you a car, here, it's your car. Well, let me check out the tires and stuff first. Like, it's a gift. You just receive it. And then you check it out after they leave. It's not polite to look a gift horse in the mouth at the time it's being given. But in this case, Seeing Buddha nature is kind of like, you know, checking out a horse's teeth. But I don't know if Dogen's playing with this, but Ashvaghosha, actually in Sanskrit, that name Ashvaghosha means horse whinny, or whinny.
Oh, whinny.
Or, you know, something that comes out of a horse's mouth. So this is the kind of thing that Dogen does, so I wouldn't put it beyond him to have a little like reference to seeing Buddha nature, seeing this particular ancestor, Ashvaghosha. Yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, you might know, you know, at the top of the paragraph, the characters that say Ashvaghosha,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't they immediately flash to a Chinese Japanese horse's mouth?
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, because sometimes they use the right. Sometimes they use the you're right. It's yeah, sometimes they, you know, transliterate like Anabote. We say in our ancestor list Anabote is a very bad transliteration of Ashvaghosha. I'm not sure where Anabote doesn't have, I don't think has horse in it, but here it is, yeah, it's a litter, in Chinese the characters for horse whinny, horse call, yeah, so yeah, exactly, you would see it in there, you'd see that character repeated at this time, yeah, right, so that's why it's hard to translate these things, right, they could say, well, the 12th ancestor horse whinny, you know, then we kind of get it, maybe late, we get the reference later, but...
Well, it's funny because the very next words are, you understand, you do not understand. How do you want to think it?
You understand, you do not understand that total dependent is whole dependence is a depending whole.
Whoa.
Yeah, so we could hear this as like, in either case, you understand what's going on here in general, or you don't understand... It doesn't matter, actually. In either case, totally dependent is whole dependence, depending whole. So again, we're talking about interdependence, or is another name for conditionality. Interdependent arising can also be called conditioned arising, dependence and conditionality. And so what we're talking about, looking at causes and conditions, is like studying dependent co-arising, but in this way where there's just one whole, it's not so much like cause and effect, cause leads to effect, a kind of linear cause and effect. There's room for studying that too, but generally in the Mahayana, like Nagarjuna is all about dependent co-arising, but he's not so much looking at like this cause leads to this effect. It's this interdependent, mutual co-arising interdependence, a depending whole, a whole dependence. Samadhi and the six supernatural powers. Anybody know the six supernatural powers? It's not one of the lists that we usually memorize.
Clairvoyance.
What's that?
Clairvoyance.
Yeah, that is one of them. Clairvoyance.
Clear hearing.
Yeah, clairaudience. Yeah, our divine eye and divine ear. Yeah, those are two.
Reading minds.
Reading minds. Hey. You got three. I had to look these up myself. Yeah.
Which one?
Appearing in more than one place at once. And I think that one gets kind of like, includes a bunch of other kind of like spatial possibilities. Like, yeah, appearing more than one place at once, or also being able to kind of walk through walls. Or actually, this is in the early sutras, the Pali canon. They often, the Buddha lists these. and they come from meditation practice. It can be developed. So walking on water is one of them, which I think is interesting because that appears in Christianity too, right? Mm-hmm. But that, what's that?
Really? Walking through walls happened at the time after the resurrection. And,
A clear, like a divine eye, being able to see very far, being able to hear very, very like far away, as far as you want, and reading others' minds, being able to fly is part of the multiple place one. So those are those are some, and then the interestingly to me, three of them are the three insights on the night of Buddha's enlightenment. So that they were kind of very much connected with the Buddha's great awakening. And actually the divine eye is one of them, this clairvoyance, but it's particularly in that case connected to this insight into his own past lives. So you could even call it like the divine eye, as I understand it, is actually being able to remember past lives way, way, way back. And he talks about how many thousands in detail. And then the other is like what the memory of past lives is one, and then what they call divine eye is actually seeing into the past lives of everybody else too. And I think you could see that that's like complete see, like a kind of vision. It's a seeing, but not the usual eye, but like a vision of like how karma, basically how karma works. You can read this in the Pali Sutras, but how like first the Buddha saw the first watch of the night, I think he saw his own past lives going back, such and such a name. It got pretty detailed, right? It wasn't just like a particular life he saw. And then he saw this like the workings of karma and the arising and the birth and death of like all countless beings everywhere apart from himself. And that's technically called divine eye. And then that's on the second watch of the night. And then the last final watch of the night in Buddha's awakening was the ceasing of all outflows. And that was truly his enlightenment. Outflows is like any kind of any kind of ignorance and delusion at all was completely dropped away. And it was like and we say that everything that came before, the other five so-called supernatural powers are like not that important. Even these first two on the night of his enlightenment weren't really the point, but this ending of ashravas, is outflows, or you know, they're listed at particular kinds of outflows, but basically like all delusion, maybe in a Mahayana version we would call it like any slight traces of any duality or sense of self and other at all, and therefore the complete ending of all suffering. That was the Buddha's great enlightenment. But he also had these other powers, and other yogis had them too. But only that last one, the ending of all outflows, is truly like the insight of Buddha's Dharma. Basically, it came from insight into the Four Noble Truths. There's actually, Dogen has a fascicle called Miraculous Powers that Catherine Danis translated with Kaz. I think called Miracles in her translation. And I think they get into Dogen's playing with, you know, this idea of magical powers in Buddhism. So anyway, samadhi and these six supernatural powers are being revealed by means of Buddha nature. Which kind of makes sense, right? The way we're hearing Buddha nature now as this totality of conditionality. Everything, mountains, rivers, and earth, the whole phenomenal world, the so-called material world, all that's arising from as Buddha nature, and then of course all kinds of mind, mental phenomena like six powers and samadhi are all revealed by means of Buddha nature. You should know that both the manifestation and the non-manifestation of samadhi are totally dependent on Buddha nature. All six supernatural powers, whether they are being revealed by the Buddha nature or not, are equally totally dependent on Buddha nature. Maybe the point being, whether they're being revealed or not revealed, you still can't talk about them in any way apart from Buddha nature. The six supernatural powers are not simply those taught in the Agama Sutras. That's the Sanskrit way of saying the Nikayas, Pali Nikayas, the Pali Canon. Six is the six supernatural powers perfected. And actually perfected there is actually the, you know, Haramitsu, the transliteration of Paramita. So, it looks like Dogen's is playing with noticing the fact that there's six paramitas, right? There's six perfections, giving, this is the Mahayana teaching, right? Giving, ethical conduct, patience, diligence, concentration, wisdom. And so here he's saying six is the six supernatural powers paramita. Almost like he's just kind of combining those into... Maybe we could hear it too as like the six supernatural powers understood as manifestations of Buddha nature are now the paramita, the powers of paramita. They've gone beyond this limited little power of just being able to walk through a wall or something. Now it's like Buddha nature ocean walking through wall. The paramita of wall walking. Three, three before, three, three after. So, because we're talking about six here, Dogen just like his kind of encyclopedic mind is just like, I gotta say it. Three, three before, three, three after, which refers, of course, to this to this koan. You know this one in the Blue Cliff Record? Can you recite it?
But it's here in the footnote.
It's here in the footnote. I always thought a strange, very strange, be interesting to hear your take on this koan sometime. Case 35 in the Blue Cliff Record, Manjushri, actually it's about strange because Manjushri is interacting with a Zen ancestor. Manjushri asks Wu Chu, where have you come from? He said, from the south. Well, what's Buddhism like in the south these days? Asked Manjushri. Chu said, monks of the latter day Dharma, this one says, do nothing but observe the precepts. But the several other translations say, monks in this age of decline no longer observe the precepts. That's how it is in the south. Manjushri said, how many are there? 300, maybe 500, said Chu. Then Chu asked Manjushri, how's Buddhism in these parts? And Manjushri said, the enlightened and the unenlightened live together, dragons and snakes mixed up together. Manjushri said, Chu said, are there many or few? And Manjushri said, three, three before, three, three after. So that's where that phrase comes from. So strange, huh?
Is there any connection in meaning between bringing in that story and his work?
Yeah, I think so.
I
think it's not just because it happens to be 3 plus 3 is 6.
Yeah.
Because all the amazing thing is that a lot of these Zen things are and the sutras are all coming around these same points. And it's actually, I think, this point about Sandokai that actually the play of the particular versus the whole Buddha nature. And Dogen's constantly coming back and forth between these. So, in fact, the footnote here says, 3-3 is not an ordinary enumeration, but indicates each individual entity immediately and distinctly manifested prior to mental discrimination. So kind of like the particular relative phenomena, just this, 3-3 before, 3-3 after, instead of like lots and lots, it's like 3-3, 3-3. It's a weird way of saying, you know, particular manifestation, and yet before this Manjushri talking, so before any discrimination. This is maybe why it sounds weird. So does that make sense why Dogen might actually say at that point? Now, what's the point again? He says this is, he's talking about totally dependent on Buddha nature, these six powers, totally inconceivably manifesting as Buddha nature. Not just the way they're taught in the early sutras. We're talking now about the perfection of the six, of these six powers perfected, meaning like their manifestations of Buddha nature, 3-3 before, 3-3 after. Meaning like these particular manifestations, but before any discrimination. Maybe a stretch, but you could see a connection, and you know it might to see the full connection might mean really contemplating this koan for a while, this strange blue click record koan with Manjushri.
It somehow to me shows the whole that in his words he's constantly weaving in from very different places. That there is no distinction between this and that and this and that.
Yeah.
That,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
The ease with which he just pulls in all these different places because it's all one.
Yeah. And often really surprisingly and in, you know, kind of, I think, really brilliant ways. And we could also hear in the koan, remember, it's Manjushri, this monk's kind of just describing this regular situation of, yeah, the monks up here, they don't practice so well, and there's about 500. And Manjushri's saying, oh, well, here, where I practice, as the perfect wisdom bodhisattva, dragons and snakes are all mixed together, like the good practitioners and the bad ones, whatever you call these different, are all like, we can't distinguish anything anymore. Well, then how many are there? He could have said, like, What are you talking about? Numbers here. I don't deal in the realm of numbers, but instead he said 3-3 before, 3-3 after. 3 before, 3 behind. And maybe Bhutchu is like, huh? But it's like Manjushri talk. But it's Manjushri talk about numbers. Yeah. So, and since we're talking about numbers here, Dogen brings up Manjushri's talk about numbers. That's these kind of six that we're talking about. So do not investigate the six supernatural powers as the clear bright tips of the myriad grasses are the clear bright purpose of the Buddha ancestors. Don't investigate them in that way, you say. And so, okay, now this is in quotes again. It's another saying of Layman Pong talking to his daughter, our woman ancestor, Ling Zhao. Charya Ling Zhao is Layman Pong's daughter, right? And they had all these great conversations. So Layman Pong says, says basically that just that quote. He says, the clear, bright tips of the myriad grasses are the clear, bright purpose of the Buddha ancestors. How do you understand that? And she said in response, the clear, bright tips of the myriad grasses are the clear, bright purpose of the Buddha ancestors. That's a little dialogue in the record of the Pong family. So, so and the, you know, the footnotes, and I think that, you know, these footnotes of Waddell and Abe and Carl Bielefeld and stuff, they're looking at these, at a lot of the classic Shobo Genzo commentaries in Japan after Dogen's time. So I think they're not completely making up all this stuff. Sometimes you wonder about their footnote interpretations. But they're often pretty good. So like this one says, they understand it as, well, Dogen doesn't want to say that the clear, bright tips of the myriad grasses are some like purpose of ancestors and stuff. He would just like to say it as the clear, bright tips of the grasses are just the clear, bright tips of the grasses. And that's how you should investigate the six supernatural powers as manifestations of Buddha nature. You shouldn't say, investigate them as like, and this is like how it fits into the Buddha's teaching and stuff. It's more like, just these being these. Just this being this. So, you might not get that from hearing this, but the sentence Dogen uses here is, again, so do not investigate the six supernatural powers as the clear, bright tips of the myriad grasses are the clear, bright purpose of the Buddha ancestors. And we could say in parentheses, just investigate them as the clear, bright tips of the myriad grasses are clear, bright tips of the myriad grasses. Things as they are, with no special dharmic purpose. To do that, if you did investigate them in this other wrong way, that would make you remain and become involved inextricably in the six supernatural powers. Which maybe even to already talk about what they are, like, yeah, so how do you do this? Walking through walls and stuff, and like, let's research the six supernatural powers, is maybe already getting too involved and inextricably like caught up in them. If we think about their purpose and like, yeah, what if we could do that, how would that help our practice? Instead, it's just like Dogen's whole take on practice is more like, just do the next thing, which is often just have a cup of tea. That's the miraculous power of Dogen. Nevertheless, that interference only occurs within the universal flow inside of the Buddha nature. See, maybe we could hear the interference of getting caught up in things. You know, even if you do get caught up in things and investigate in these wrong ways that just distract you from the practice, even that only occurs within the universal flow inside of the ocean of Buddha nature.
Tanahashi's translation is, to me, much clearer. It says, so do not think that the six miraculous powers are limited to the 100 grasses bright and clear and the mind of Buddha ancestors bright and clear. Even though you may be limited by the thought of the six miraculous powers, you are immersed in the vastness of the ocean of Buddha nature.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, that really makes it clear that, which Dogen, one of my favorite parts about what he does is he'll kind of sort of criticize some practice or kind of scold us a little bit about getting off track, and then he forgives us. You know, he says like, even if you go off track, you're still like immersed in Buddha nature. He does that a lot, and it's one of the greatest things about it. It's like he's got to like, we don't want to get all wishy-washy, so kind of like get a little strict, but then say, kind of, and by the way, You know, you can't really go wrong. But don't go wrong. In a way, that's this, you know, these two sides. That's Sandokai too, right? You can't go wrong, but don't go wrong. Next story. The fifth ancestor, Zen master Da Man, hailed from Huangmei in Zhejiang. He was born without a father, and he attained the way while still a child. Now you might think, well, that just meant his father left when he was young and he was raised by his mother. But as you hear the story, he was actually born without a father.
He was also picked up by Christianity.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, this is a little... This is... it's sort of miraculous, but it's sort of like... Well, you'll hear the story. In his previous existence, he was a man named Sai Sung Gao Che, the pine-planting man of the way. In his old age, planting pine saplings at Xishan and Zhejiang, he encountered the fourth Zen ancestor, Dai Daoxin, who was on an excursion away from the monastery. The fourth ancestor said, "I would like to transmit my Dharma to you, but I'm afraid you're too old. If you happen to get reborn into the human world, I'll be waiting for you." Sai Sung nodded his agreement. Later, at the house of a man named Zhao, he got reborn as the son of Zhao's daughter. She abandoned the infant in a muddy creek, but he was protected by divine messengers. Seeing that he remained unharmed even after 7 days had passed, the daughter retrieved him and raised him, and he passed a normal childhood. One day, at the age of 7, he was traveling to Mount Huangmei. He met the fourth ancestor, Dai Yi. Even though he was still a child, Dai Yi discerned that he possessed a physiognomy that set him apart from ordinary children. Do they have that in Christianity? Strange physiognomy?
I don't know
what strange
physiognomy
is. Like,
I don't understand why this is different.
So here's the story. This is it doesn't get told so completely in this version. So in the transmission of light, we have, this is how, you know, just like it said there, he was this old pine planting pilgrim, and he said, "May I hear the Buddha Dharma?" And the fourth ancestor said, "You're too old. Even if you hear it, would you be able to teach it for very long? But if you come again in the next life, I will wait for you." So this pilgrim, this old fellow, left and went to a river where he saw a young girl washing clothes. He bowed and asked her, "May I have some lodging for the night?" And in the parentheses here, in this translation, it says, i.e., "May I temporarily borrow your womb?" Yeah. "May I temporarily borrow your womb?" The girl replied, "I have to ask my parents." And the ancestor said, "If they consent, I will go and do it." She assented, and finally she returned to her village. The girl was the youngest daughter of a family named Zhao. When she returned home, she was pregnant. So that's how this happened. Very mysteriously. She just went home to ask her parents if he could have lodging for the night, and by the time she got home, she was already pregnant. So something happened there, right? And what happened to the old guy? We don't hear in the story. Did he immediately just fall over as a corpse, and with his intense powers of cultivation and concentration, choose a rebirth in her womb, kind of miraculously, or what? We don't know, but this is the story of the fifth ancestor of Zen. And then this story elaborates a little bit more too, that when she got home pregnant, her parents detested her and drove her out of the house. She had no place to turn to, so she worked in the village as a spinner by day and stayed at an inn by night. Finally, she had a child, and thinking that he was unlucky, because he was the cause of all her problems, right? She left him in the river. However, he was not swept away by the current, and he was not even wet. Spirits protected and cared for him for 7 days. These spirits were two birds who covered him with their wings during the day, and two dogs who guarded him at night by crouching over him. He remained fresh in body and mind with no loss of faculties. When she saw this, his mother thought it was remarkable, and she began to feed him. So now maybe he's not so unlucky anymore right now. It's like, something special here. He begged for food with his mother while he was growing up. People called him the nameless child. A wise man said, the child has all but 7 of the marks of a Tathagata. Like, that's the unusual physiognomy. Mm-hmm. Later he met the 4th ancestor on a walk, and the 4th ancestor thought that his bone structure was unusual, quite unlike that of an ordinary boy. So he asked, what's your name? And that's the story here. Crushes your. Yeah, there's a couple of these Indian stories where they there's another one where one of the ancestors feels this like intense headache. And then he wakes up the next day and he's got like all these lumps on top of his head. And it's like the changing of bones through some kind of miraculous power. So now the story. So now this young 7-year-old boy meets the 5th ancestor. So kind of interesting that we can hear this, it's just a weird kind of magical story, right? But I think the practice principle we could hear is like this vow, right? You could even see like, talk about like devotion in the teacher-student relationship, right? He's like, I really want to be your student and receive your dharma. And he's like, I really wish you could do this, but you're too old. And like, but come back. And like through his vow, right, his deep intention, like, I will. I'm gonna find a way to do this, actually. Excuse me, can I borrow your womb? Yeah. Like, he didn't even wait. He didn't even, like, wait to think about how we're going to work it out. He's like, next young woman he meets, right, I need to be reborn as soon as possible. And then he grew to 7 years, right? So 7 years later, he patiently got old enough to talk and stuff. And then they had this meeting. So whether or not it happened like this, I hear it as like, it's like a bodhicitta story. Mm-hmm. I'm going to find a way to do this, even if it means in another body and another life. Mm-hmm. We have a karmic connection here too, right? We're going to meet again. It's not even like, I'll just go find some other dharma teacher. It's like, no, we have this link. We have to do this. So the ancestor asks, what's your name? And so here's another, actually this is kind of like a word play that Dogen's not bringing up, but it's actually in the Chinese story, that the character for name and nature are homonyms. They sound the same. Xing in Chinese, or Shou in Japanese, Bu Shou, right? And the characters look almost identical too. They both have a kind of the radical for life. So if you know Chinese characters, the character for name, and this means like family name actually, like family name, and they use this character, interestingly, for the Sanskrit word gotra. And I can't remember if we talked about this the first class, but gotra is one of those synonyms for Buddha nature. It's like the family or lineage of Buddhas. It's one of the many synonyms for Tathagata Garba or Buddha nature. Gotra, literally means like lineage or family, and it's a synonym of Buddha nature in the Indian tradition, and this is the one they use for like family name, which is kind of like a nature. So the Chinese character has like the radical for woman and life put together, and the character for nature has the radical of heart and life put together. Heart or mind, mind and life is the show of Buddha nature. So they look very similar and they sound the same, and they even have this, there's even a little play on the meaning of like the family name or has this connection to Buddha nature, right? And nature, as the Chinese character, also means like, interestingly, it can mean like gender, just the standard Chinese translation of the show of nature can mean like a disposition or a custom, a quality of something, or even gender or the sex of something, someone. So, which is similar to this, family, family roots, right? Has to do with humanness and so on. So there's some connection between these two characters, but in English it just sounds as like name and nature. So in this translation, the translators down below, they choose to, everywhere it says your name, they put in parentheses nature, because Dogen's kind of like equating these, basically, in his commentary, name and nature. So, but even in the original Chinese story, the ancestor asks, what's your name? What's your show? And the Buddha replied, I have a name, but it's not an ordinary name. And of course they're speaking, so it could mean, what's your nature, right? But probably it was more common to ask, what's your name? You know, what's your show? I have a show, but it's not an ordinary show. What show is that? What name is that? Asked the ancestor. It's Bu Show. Buddha nature, said the boy. So in the written form, it's, what name is that? It's Buddha nature. But if they're speaking, it just sounds like, what show is that? It's Buddha show, Bu Show. See how that goes? Because they sound the same. So the boy is kind of playing with these questions. What's your name? I have a name, but it's not an ordinary name. What name is that? It's Buddha nature, said the boy. You have no Buddha nature, said the fourth ancestor. You say no Buddha nature because Buddha nature is emptiness, the boy replied. The ancestor then knew that this boy was a vessel for Buddha Dharma. And he made him his attendant, and in the course of time he imparted to him the treasury of the true Dharma eye. Taking up residence on the east peak of Mount Huangmei, the fifth ancestor spread the Dharma widely and exalted its profound depths. Or he wielded the dark wind, the mysterious style of Zen. Now Dogen says, when we penetrate the utterances of the two ancestors, we find that the fourth ancestor's what is your name contains a meaning of essential significance. In the past, there was a man from the land of what? There was a family named what? So what is one of these words that Dogen uses in various places, because in a lot of these Zen stories, there's a question of like, what is it that thus comes, what is the meaning of the ancestors coming from the West? They're often asking these what questions, and over and over again, Dogen, in many of his writings, likes to turn that interrogative word what into like, suchness. Turn it from a question into an expression. And it does have that pre-Dogen too. The meaning of what is like another word, a kind of a Zen, sort of slang Zen word for like suchness. you know, the suchness of things is the ineffable what of things. Right? So turning it from what is it to what is it? What is it? What it is. What is it? Or it is what. What meaning like the inexpressible expression of suchness. So that's what Dogen is here. He's saying, in the past there was a man from the land of what. There was a family named what. Here the fourth ancestor is teaching the boy, your family name is what. Because he actually originally asks, what is your name? Your family name is what. This is the same as saying, I am thus, you are thus too. Which is comes from another Zen story. The fifth ancestor said, I have a name, in parentheses, nature, but it's not an ordinary name. You know, they're using the word name, but it's the same sound as nature. In other words, a name, parentheses, nature, that is self-identical with being is not an ordinary name, nature. For an ordinary name, nature, is not self-identical with being. So this is like, to see in the Chinese, it's, the sentence is like, I have a name is Shosoku-u, which is like name, or parentheses nature, that sho. Shosoku is, means like, is, basically. Is, like we, in the Heart Sutra, we, for, ku, yeah, sokuze, ku sokuze. So form itself is emptiness, and the ze is going to appear in this next sentence too, but form is emptiness, soku. So this is like nature, so it's again that character u that came up at the beginning that means have, all beings have Buddha nature. All beings u Buddha nature can also mean are, right? So shosoku u is like name, I have a name, is how it appears, how it's usually translated in the Chinese. I have a name. Literally, the characters would be like, name is have. You know, that's just how they would write it in Chinese. But then Dogen says, turns that u from have into the into existence. It's the u that's the opposite of mu. It can mean have, or it can mean be, or it can mean exist, or existence. So in this case, Dogen's reading, instead of name is ha, or name, yeah, name have, name is had by me, it turns it to name is existence. And so in this, here he says, in other words, a name that is self-identical with being, or existence, with actual being, is not an ordinary name. For an ordinary name is not self-identical with being. Self-identical is that soku. So he's saying, name is being here. And he's now using, instead of just this ordinary thing of having a name, saying name is the being. Remember, it's the whole being. Shitsu-u, whole being, is Buddha nature. So this name is whole being. That's not an ordinary name anymore. You know, it's really like, I don't know if, you know, people reading this in the Japanese or Chinese, if this is all like, oh, really clear, or if it's just, if they have to really unpack it in this way. But I think in English, it's really, you know, there's no way to translate it in the way that Dogen is doing, playing with this. You have to kind of like unpack it in this, through this Chinese grammar, right? So, for an ordinary name is not self-identical with being. Basically, the point that, like, we're talking about, ordinary name isn't, or the ordinary understanding of a name or a nature is not whole being. That's, you know, extraordinary realization of Buddha nature. What the fourth ancestor said, when the fourth ancestor said, "What name is that?" What is an affirmation? So affirmation here is zei, the same as soku zei ku, shiki soku zei ku in the Heart Sutra is form itself is emptiness. This very form is emptiness. It would, like, the zei is like this. Form is this emptiness. It's kind of emphasizing the particularity. It's a kind of nice emphasis in the Heart Sutra there that we, again, kind of lose in English. I think we say it, form itself is emptiness. I think that itself is kind of like the zei. We don't just say form is emptiness. Form, this very form itself is emptiness. Or mind itself is Buddha. How do we say that? What's that fascicle?
This very mind.
Yeah, this very mind is Buddha. Soku shin zei butsu. They split it up there. Soku shin zei butsu is the name of Buddha's fascicle. This very mind is Buddha. the original sentence, "What name is that?" In Chinese, it's like zei ka. I think it's ka sho. Ka is like the question. So, like, this, what name? This is how Chinese grammar works. But Dogen picks up on that zei, and the translating it here is affirmation. So, what name is that? When the fourth answer says, "What name is that?" What is an affirmation? Or the ka is a zei. He's just using the same characters from the sentence. I know this is hard to imagine what's happening here. He is whatting an affirmation. He's whatting an affirmation. What is his name? Whatting is possible because it is an affirmation. His affirmation is possible by virtue of what? His name, or nature, is both it, affirmation, and what. So we're basically just tying in what being like the inconceivable, ineffable suchness of things, and with the specific zei itself, this very what and nature. So it's kind of, we're almost like Dogen's like elevating each one of these Chinese characters to like be like a complete expression of Buddha nature. Like zei expresses the whole thing, and like this or itself, that's Buddha nature. What also expresses the whole thing. Name and nature expresses the whole thing. So he's just kind of like taking these very simple, ordinary sentences, and just like every word becomes like this like shining jewel of Buddha nature expression.
Could it be that what is the general and it is the specific?
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah, or what is like, or if we're talking about like the two truths, or the Sandokai, kind of like where the ultimate meets the relative. You could say the what is like the ultimate, and the this or the zei or the affirmation, the it is like the relative specific. Yeah, so there's always playing with that dynamic of these two sides coming together, and he's just in very creative ways pulling this out of these sentences where no one would ever think of pulling them out. Yeah, then it's his name is both it and what. It is infused in herbal tea. Mugwort tea, I think it's specifically. It's infused in your... Yeah, one footnote says, I think they're not sure quite what the Chinese is, but the speculation is mugwort, yeah. it's infused in ordinary green tea, and it's... and it's your daily rice as well. So that's just, you know, it's going from the kind of like cosmically confusing grammatical breakdown where the sentence is like flying all around the room to like, and by the way, it's your tea and your rice. Yeah. Tea and rice and Zen are like, you know, the ordinary, everyday, you know, things of life, of daily life. I think even like a Kaz's translation of Shobo Genzo, is it, I forget what, is it Kajo? It's literally the fascicle is called tea and rice, or everyday rice, something like that. And he translates it as like everyday activity. So I think in Chinese, tea and rice means everyday activity. Because it's just like everybody lives on tea and rice in China and Japan. They still do. Well, maybe we have to stop.
Tea and rice is a good place. It has returned me to
yeah,
that's my body.
All these zays and shows and sokus and what is it? Oh, what it is. And meanwhile, yeah, go have some tea and rice. Yeah, I keep having idealistic fantasies that we're going to get further along. It's slow going.
Yeah.
And,
like Tuesday morning.
Yeah. So, again, I hope that it can have, when you hear all this, that like something turns around or it has some effect, you know, it seems like, it can seem so abstract and like, well, it's kind of fun and it makes us appreciate Dogen, but is this really helpful? One might ask that, and so I think it definitely has the potential to be. It's just like how, when we're hearing it, how we, besides just understanding the words, can we also feel, receive, experience something like the vaster like workings of Buddha nature coming through our confusion and our kind of insight and then back to our confusion and then and all these strange stories. It's about our everyday tea and life. May all beings express their Buddha nature throughout space and time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. Surpassable, I vow to become.